This is the Best of Game Time podcast. Highlights of today's 1620 The Zone's Game Time in bite-sized pieces. Hear Nick's entire past show on 1620thezone.com's Game Time podcast page and live 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. weekdays on 1620 The Zone, the 1620 The Zone app, and 1620thezone.com.
Hey guys, thanks for downloading the Best of Podcast. In today's episode, dive into how I'm just so thankful Frost is here so we don't have silly, illogical thoughts on Nebraska football. I'll give you my thoughts on that. Plus, Nebraska FBI projected win total at 5.5. My take on that. Also, Manziel and the Dan Patrick Show. His answer kind of rubbed me the wrong way. And a great conversation with Matt Schick. Enjoy the podcast. So I am obviously excited that Scott Frost is here for a bunch of reasons. Number one, I think he's a great coach. Number two, I think he is the guy that is going to turn the program around. I think it's a great story, obviously. Local guy, born and raised in Nebraska, won a national title here, goes off, flourishes, comes back. Like, there are a lot of reasons why the Scott Frost story is fantastic and why I'm excited that Scott Frost is here. But another big reason why I'm glad Scott Frost is here is because that means I don't have to listen to idiotic rationalizations, thoughts, and takes on the Nebraska football program. Because no offense, there was a lot of that over the last couple of years. Like, it almost feels like we are back to talking about things that make sense with football, with Scott Frost back. I know that's not, like, I don't feel like there's been a really nonsensical discussion on Nebraska in a while. You know, like, the type of discussion where you're like, what are we even talking about right now? Or, like, really, that's what you think? Like, I don't really, I feel like we are now grounded more in reality than we, and I say we being just Nebraskans, media fans, everybody, than we've ever been. I'm sorry, with Mike Riley, it always felt like we were rationalizing and justifying and arguing silly things. Things that lacked logic. And I was always so fascinated with Mike Riley here, it seemed like more so than even usual, people became obsessed with recruiting. Now, I think that's a subconscious kind of coping mechanism that is a product of not winning in the season. So the way people kind of coped with it was just to invest everything into recruiting, everything into the future. So much so that it got to the point, and these were real things being said. It got to the point where it's like, you can't fire Mike Riley. You'll lose Buki if you fire Mike Riley. These are real comments from people. Oh, you can't fire Mike Riley. Really, you'll live with a 4-8 season, awful football program going in the wrong direction just to get a 5-11 corner. Just say it out loud, people. But the other thing that was silly was how much people were obsessed with recruiting, and that became the only thing people cared about with a coach's resume. Like, that was it. Whether it was a head coach, a position coach, a coordinator, it was like, the only thing that matters when we're looking at that job resume is, how are you as a recruiter? Like, that was it.
And that got put on steroids. Remember when Dante Williams was hired?
Yes.
That was like almost the only thing that was discussed about him.
People argued and argued and argued and argued for Dante Williams, who clearly ended up not being a great coach. But people argued for him, championed for him, loved, all because he could supposedly recruit. It's like people were so blinded. And some maybe didn't realize that it was all kind of just they had to deal with the fact that games were coming and going and they weren't winning games. And they took all that kind of fandom and energy and put it towards recruiting. People were so blinded by that that people argued time and time again, the number one thing they want in a coach is recruiting. Recruiting's all that matters. It's recruiting. That's all that matters. You realize that all that matters is recruiting. It doesn't matter if the guy can't coach his way out of a paper bag. Can he recruit? That's all that matters. Doesn't matter if you got an average or bad coach. As long as they recruit, I'm all in. Ugh. God, the point was like, it was nauseating. I mean, literally, we would get people, I would get emails throughout the season last year. You can't fire Mike Riley or you will lose the recruiting class. You can't fire Mike Riley or we'll lose Pookie. You realize we'd lose Pookie. You can't lose Pookie. What? Like, those were real comments. And it's just funny to think about that and contrast it yesterday. So we have Greg McDermott on the show. And I'm certainly, I mean, it's not apples to apples and all that stuff. But I mean, nevertheless, the same school of thought can apply. That's Greg McDermott about the hiring of Paul Lusk. I said, hey, coach, you know, what was it about Paul Lusk? What were some of the things you were looking for? Was, you know, recruiting, coach? Like, what were some of the things you were looking for? Here's Coach Mack.
Well, I don't think I would ever hire a guy that's just a recruiter. I want guys that can coach basketball, and I want guys that, you know, their dream is to become a head coach. And I think it's part of my responsibility to help them continue to check boxes so that they can become a head coach.
I would never hire a guy who's just a recruiter. And all I heard from a lot of people for a year and a half was recruiting was the only thing that mattered, the number one thing on a resume. That it was the number one requirement for the job. I don't care if the defensive backs coach knows how to coach defensive backs. Can he recruit? I mean, it feels like Frost returning has almost smacked us all into a logical place. The talking points, the rationalizations, the excuses, it got exhausting under Riley. It really did. Because, again, to me, a lot of them weren't based in logic. And a lot of it stemmed from a place where recruiting trumped all. It was like, I don't care about a 5-7 season. I don't care about a 4-8 season. I don't care about this. I don't care as long as recruiting. And, again, don't get me wrong. I'm certainly not suggesting that recruiting doesn't matter. Of course it matters. But there were a lot of people over the last couple of years that seemingly tried to argue that recruiting trumped everything. And that it doesn't matter if a guy isn't a very good coach. As long as you can recruit, that's all that matters. You can't fire Mike Riley. You'd lose Pookie. You can't make a coaching change. You can't make a coaching change. You'd lose. What about recruiting? Well, what about coaching? What about coaching? And so it just is so nice to have a guy in Scott Frost here that, to me, not only because I believe in him, but just it feels like we've centered ourselves. We've centered ourselves to a place of logic in what we're just talking about. It's so nice. It's so refreshing. Just thought it was funny. You know, Corey and I were listening to an interview yesterday with Mac. And I'd never hire a coach who was just a recruiter. Amen to that.
And I'm sure a lot of people can jive with this, but sometimes when you know something is wrong, and you're stressed out about it, and your mind's going a thousand miles a minute, sometimes you need somebody to give you a literal or figurative slap in the face.
Yeah.
Just to kind of recenter your thoughts. And that's where, like, I agree with you. That's what I think Scott Frost has done. I mean, the talking points throughout the Mike Riley era were nauseating. Constant justifications, constant kind of tap dancing around the fact that Mike Riley was a 500 coach and he always has been, that Bob Diaco was going to somehow fly into Lincoln and bring back the black shirts after he had just had a horrific stint with UConn as a head coach. And you could argue, you can make the argument at this point that his defensive acumen was a lot due to riding the coattails of Brian Kelly at Notre Dame.
Right.
It seems like Scott Frost has just kind of smacked everybody back into their senses.
I just like that we're back to a place where
we're having real football discussions, and
we're having results-based discussions. Like, that's the thing, like, where what someone has done matters. It's not what it would be Northern Illinois comes in, wins, you know, can't stop anybody against Oregon, can't stop all this stuff. Well, listen, you can't. What about Buki? What about coaching? What about results on the field on Saturdays? What about that? Somewhere along the lines, and I think it's just a subconscious coping mechanism from certain people that somewhere along the lines, it became signing day was more important than game day. And it got exhausting. And it just feels good that we are in a place, to me at least, that seems like we're more grounded in logical discussions as it pertains to the Nebraska football program. And there are a lot of reasons that I am excited about Scott Frost being here. This is one of them. We're just, it feels like we are in a much better place.
See, and I thought this past year, I don't know, I don't even think you were here, but signing day in February to me this year was just, it was far less nauseating than it normally is around here. And I thought the majority of that had to do with the first signing period.
Yeah,
you spread things out a little bit more.
It broke it up.
But I really do think that a lot of that had to do with Nebraska's got a coach here that you could realistically see actually making something out of these recruits.
Sure, sure.
Didn't have that with Riley.
No.
Didn't have that with Diaco. You have that with Frost.
Yeah, it just did. Thank God. It was tough to listen to at times. It really was. So I've been over the past couple of weeks, like I've been complimentary of Johnny Manziel the last few weeks, and to me, how he's approached getting himself back in the conversation of the NFL, you know, doing like multiple pro days, doing multiple interviews, like he has been doing and saying a lot of the right things to me. Except what I found yesterday, so Johnny Manziel went on the Dan Patrick show, and I'm not gonna lie, I found what he said yesterday to be kind of the first thing that kind of rubbed me the wrong way. So Manziel yesterday on Dan Patrick was oft asked about what he would do different in his rookie year, and I thought his answer was kind of like eyebrow raising. Here is Johnny Manziel on the Dan Patrick show.
I see successful guys in the NFL and what they do in the offseason and the time that they put in that makes them good players. Yes, they're athletically gifted, but guys are good in the NFL because they know film, they study hard, and they work even harder in the offseason. So I didn't know that. And I feel like if Cleveland did any of their homework, they would have known that I was a guy that didn't come in every day and watch film. I was a guy that didn't really know the X's and O's of football. I played in a spread offense. We looked at bubbles. We looked at flats. We had progression reads across the field. It wasn't like it was a super intricate, like, pro system. So when I get to Cleveland, you know, I have a quarterback in the room with me that's not helping me. And it's not really his job, too, but nobody was there, like, helping me go over the X's and O's. And it was hard. I struggled.
Okay, there's a lot of, really? That comes off as almost like you're going to blame Cleveland for things not, like, if Cleveland did any of their homework. To me, that lacks accountability and lacks self-awareness. And I love the start. He talks about, like, the people that are good in the NFL, it's they work hard, they study film, and they're prepared. And I didn't know that. You didn't know that? You didn't know that. You didn't know that hard work, preparation correlated to success. That is a foreign concept to you. I mean, Manziel acts like the idea of watching film, preparing for the game, diving into the playbook. Nobody ever told him that was important. I had no idea watching film was important. Come on, man. There hits a point where the excuses for common sense things and basic stuff falls on deaf ears for me. I've always thought the most dangerous people are the guys who act like idiots but are actually pretty sharp, smart people. Those are the guys that are the biggest. Those are the guys that are really dangerous. And there's always been a little bit of like Manziel's like a con artist. He's a little like he's charming. He seems like one of those guys that'll tell you what you want to hear. All the like, I could totally see how you could sit down with Manziel and he could know like understand all the greatest hits of things that you need to like I need to tell you. I've been around some guys in my playing days that truthfully couldn't get out of their own way. And pardon my bluntness, they were idiots. And their decision-making reflected that. But I've also been around guys who are actually smart, intelligent, sharp guys that actively make bad decisions. And trust me, those guys always are a little bit more dangerous to me than the other, like P. Allen Stinnett, on like, charming, sharp, charismatic guy. Oh man, you get P. Allen, like when he wanted to, he could get around some millionaire boosters and charm the pants off them, but then turn around and steal from us in the locker room. P. Allen knew what was right and what was wrong, and he still made the bad decisions. Manziel strikes me a little bit as that. I mean, Manziel paints a picture like nobody ever in his life told him what it took to be a good quarterback. Film, game prep, taking care of your body. And he also paints a picture like no coach at Cleveland ever helped him. Like he literally was like walking around with like his playbook, like little help here. Anybody? No? Okay, I'm third. I'm looking at the blitz. Any help? Help! Hey, no, help! Shut up! Like what? No one helped me with the X's. No one helped you with the X's and O's. No one helped you. No one helped you. Literally, nobody helped you. No one wanted to help you. Or did you not ask for help? Did you not want help? Did you not show up? Did you, instead of watching film, go out and part like that? Now, is maybe that what it was, Johnny? Was maybe it's a little more you than Cleveland? Come on. Like, I just don't love the idea that when Manziel reflects on his time in the NFL, he still doesn't blame himself first. Listen. Nobody is painting Cleveland like it's a first-class, big-time, great organization. But if the idea in his head that is reigning supreme is that he failed because of Cleveland, then he's never going to succeed. Again, I've been complimentary of Manziel. I think he's done a lot of the right things during the past month, and I have no reason to want to, like, it's not like I want to see Manziel fail. But I just thought that answer was a window into his mindset, and I didn't love what I heard. No idea that film. I didn't know that. I had no idea. That rubs me the wrong way a little bit. I'm not going to lie to you guys. 402-951-1620. So let me shift gears to this real quick. I always think, like, sometimes I think we can read too much into maybe what coaches say and all that stuff in for spring practice and all that. But I thought I thought it was interesting that some of the stuff that Barrett Rude said today after practice. He talked about how at this point four linebackers have kind of separated themselves. Muhammad Berry, Dedrick Young, Will Honus, and Avery Roberts. So you talk about those first impressions, the kind of gut reaction to what your eyes are telling you in practice, who looks like they got the physical tools, who has picked things up, all that's in the film room, concepts, all that stuff. You have four guys that have separated themselves. Mo Berry, Dedrick Young, Honus, Avery Roberts. And then I thought this quote was good from Barrett. And Barrett's talked about this. And it's a small thing, but it matters. This is from Brian Christopherson. It's a quote from Barrett Rude after practice today. He said, quote, "The biggest thing we got to get back to at Nebraska, you have to know when you play Nebraska. That was the biggest thing when we were really, really good here. Everybody knew what they were getting into when you played Nebraska from a physical standpoint." And I totally agree. And I think I think it goes beyond just physicality. I think it just goes to like when people play a certain team, they know, they understand that this thing's not going to be easy, that they got their work cut out for them. And that's something that I do. When we talk about what are some things that can be changed quickly, that what Barrett Rude's talking about, like that's something that can get changed fast. And look no further than another Big Ten West team in Purdue. Purdue is officially at the point where when you see Purdue on the schedule, you're not just penciling in a win and saying this is going to be easy. You are now saying this is going to be we are going to have a four-quarter fight on our hands. This team's going to be physical. They're going to pound you. They're going to come at you. And over the, let's be honest, for the past couple of years, that wasn't the case with Nebraska football. And when we talk about things that can actually be changed in a short amount of time, to me, that is something that can absolutely get changed. Physicality, people understanding when Nebraska comes to town or you go to Lincoln, this is going to be a war. That you better have your chin strap buckled up tight because it's on. That's something that can get flipped in a hurry. And I think oftentimes the people to spearhead that change are the physical ass, like the linebackers, the O-line, the D-line. The thumpers, if you will. Like those are the people, the tone setters of your team that can flip that in a hurry. All right, I don't know how we're supposed to do this. We have like 13 minutes to try and have a conversation, Matt. I don't know how this is going to work. You have any idea this is going to work?
Well, no. It could have been longer if Corey knew how to read English.
Yeah. Okay, you know how, obviously, you've people are not familiar, you've actually you've hosted a radio show in this very radio station. Mm-hmm. And you know you got the call screen in the stack, and Corey types at 11:27. Schick is out tomorrow because of the Masters. Want to talk to him next? He's available. I'm like, yes, I do want to talk to him. So I don't know what this is going to look like here.
Yeah, how about Corey read you the text that like I sent him like early this morning at like 8:30 a.m.
Yeah,
Central Time.
Yeah. I mean,
a jerk store.
Yeah, what a jerk store. All right,
unbelievable.
You want to read the text?
I'll read it. I'll read it.
All right,
I own it.
Schick is a good.
I own it, but I'll read it. FYI. I'm at the Masters tomorrow, no phone all day. Could tape today before the show or go anytime before 12:30. What I left out when I initially read it was the no phone all day part.
Why are you at the Masters? What the H?
Well, there's two choices. One, I'm anchoring SportsCenter coverage of it, or I just got tickets and I'm going to hang out.
You are...
What do you think?
Shut up, Matt. Are you...
So I got tickets, so I'm gonna go hang out.
Either way, it's amazing. Either way, I'm impressed.
Yeah, either way. I mean,
either way, it's great. It's great, man. That's great. That's great. Like, can you, if you go down there, can you propose what we proposed, that these golfers should have to mirror what us amateur golfers have to do, and that's showing up 3 minutes before your tee time. You can't find a tee. You can't. There's no time in the practice range. Like that. That's what the people want to see, right?
And breakfast balls.
And breakfast balls. I would vote yes on one molly around. I would vote yes on that.
Look, I don't know why we're so why we can't be progressive in that. I know it takes us 40 years to shorten the shot clock 5 seconds in men's college basketball, but I don't know why we can't in golf just make it a little more interesting, make it more like the common man and say, okay, he's got one molly left. He's one shot back on 18 here at the Masters. His drive goes into the azaleas. He's going to take his molly and he blisters it. Like, I don't know why we don't just allow some freebies here and just change the game a little bit. I just don't know why we're so opposed to it.
Anybody that's played in any sort of scramble that like you have mulligans, like there is some strategy behind, like, are we seriously going to use our mulligan here? Nah, we can't use it. Like, I would be like a mic'd up conversation between a caddy and a professional discussing if they want to use their mulligan here, I think is great television.
And I think you could use it on any shot. I think, you know, you get to the 18th at the Masters, and, you know, say back in the day, Phil with that putt to make it, he misses it.
Right.
And then Bob Barker shows up and hits it and says, the Masters in one or two. And the logo flips around.
And guess what,
buddy? You got one more shot at this because you didn't use your mullet. You were rewarded for playing well.
I would love to hear, like, golf analysts have to be like, hey, I have to keep in mind that Ricky's got his mulligan here as he turns the corner for Amen. Like, I want to see that. I don't know who would be opposed to that. Come on.
How about this? So you got a mully left. You also have an opportunity to flag down the beer cart once.
Yes. Yes. You get one. Yeah, you know, right. Right. I'm with you on that.
Yeah. Now, if you're playing really well, your opponent can use it against you.
Right. Right. He's hot. Hey, he's got a couple birdies in a row. He's flagging down. Up. He's flagging down the drink cart, girl. Rory's hot. Rory's hot.
Yep. Like, hey, my opponent's playing too well. Need to get him a little Michelob.
I mean, this is, at one point, everybody throughout the course of the day has to let a group play through. You at some point, you have to stop. Like, it's almost like music. Like, at some point, the music stops, and the group behind you has to play through. You have to stop. You have to deal with the pressure of playing through. Let's be honest. The average score when you are playing through is at least a double bogey, right? Because you're just like, you don't take your time when you're playing through.
And I don't want this to sound bad, but I think guys would really identify with this. Like, this is going to sound terrible when I say it, but there should be a group of four women who just started playing golf.
So intermingled today.
Yes.
There's a foursome of women
in the middle of the course.
I'm totally with it. I'm totally with it.
You know what? If you want to be PC about it, it can be two women and two guys, but they have to at least be over 40.
Yep. And they are playing
the course at some point, and they are playing all day. So if you have an early tee time, you're actually, you know, better off. Those late, I mean, they're going to be struggling.
Yep. Yeah. I mean,
but they're out there all day, and you will encounter them, and you will have to wait. And they're not ordered to let you play through. You might have to get a little aggressive.
And you might even run into a situation where we're like,
let's go over to 14 where the amateur group has forgotten to put the flag back in the hole. So that's going to be problematic for Tiger. He's not quite sure where the flag is, or you know, they don't rake the sand traps. Like, oh, that's terrible. Here's up. Spieth is in the sand trap. It was not raked by the amateurs. Like, that is what we, the common folk, have to deal with. Okay.
Yeah, yeah. He didn't replace his divot on the tee box or on the green. Now he's got some pot marks to deal with. This could be a challenge here. Tiger goes for his green jacket.
I want to make this more. You know, we always talk about like golf isn't relatable, man. Well, everything we just proposed, it makes it more relatable.
Well, and that's it. Like I've heard so many great things, and I'm sure when I set foot on the course for the first time tomorrow, it's going to be incredible. And then there's also probably going to part of me that says, this isn't real life. Like,
yeah.
This is golf nirvana, golf in heaven. And this is not what I'm used to.
This isn't
to.
Real
yeah,
at all.
Where are the golf carts? Where are the people, you know, yelling at you because you're playing too slow?
The sprinklers might come on at some point. Like someone literally might be mowing the fairway as you are teeing off. Like that's just once. What I would like too is once a tournament. Now you can choose when this happens. And you have to talk to whoever you're playing with. You have to play 18 holes with a jambox. You know, with like music coming out of your caddy's bag. Like that's how it has to go. Where you just got to deal with it.
I'm with you there. I think all golfers should also have to check in themselves and the pro shop. They have to walk up there.
Yep. Right.
Check in. Yes. Your name. Yes. Tiger 1037. They walk out and then they have to check in with the starter.
Yep. Right.
They walk by, like, do everything themselves. You
mirror,
know? I mean,
yes,
they,
mirror it.
They're
mirror.
Pretty coddled. Yeah, they're pretty
they're coddled. Totally
right
coddled.
Now.
It's ridiculous. How about what happened to my guy that literally looked like he broke his ankle yesterday? Did you see that? That looked like the.
Oh,
what happened there?
Yeah, I tweeted that boy. He was.
What happened?
Tony. That was. That was
Tony has sprained it again.
I mean, he really he puts the ow in phenol. All right, everyone, calm down.
Did we get an actual like diagnosis of what happened? Because it literally looked like it was dislocated, and he had to pop it back in.
I think that was the actual diagnosis: a dislocated ankle, and he had an MRI, and he's good to go.
He's all right.
Who would it be? Like Martin Gramatica or Bill Gramatica is like, hey, calm down a little bit. It's just a par three. you don't need to celebrate like that.
Calm down. Dude.
Yeah, nothing like celebrating a hole in one on a par three contest, sprinting down the course and then nearly derailing your Masters performance.
I mean, that was brutal. That was not good.
Watching that.
Yeah.
It was great.
As someone that has bad ankles that sprains his ankle, like, I have sprained my ankle mowing the lawn. Like, literally picture someone pushing the lawnmower, then the ankle gives, and literally I went to the ground. Like, I don't think there's any golfer I identify with more than that guy.
Yeah, and it's unfortunate, too, because, you know, mowing the lawn, you can kind of, if you have the Toro self-pace, you can pick up some steam.
Yeah, you can.
You know, you're turning, you're this, you're that. It's hard to sprain an ankle in golf sprinting when you're not supposed to sprint. So that's actually a gig against the surprised they even allowed him back on the course.
That's right. There's no, it's
running.
Bad decorum.
He can't run.
Yeah, you can't. I mean, yeah, golf shoes are not meant to run in. I mean, you're going to hurt yourself.
Two things you can't do at the Masters. Turn your golf court. You have to, two things you must do. Walk slowly and cut across the fairway at 90 degrees.
90 degree rule. That's right. Yeah. Maybe they should implement that one day. One day there is literally like your caddy can't come with you. You have to be 90 degrees away and you have to figure out what your lie is. Take a couple of clubs over there. Like we should, that should also be a part of this thing.
I've always wondered why we're so against the golf carts. Golf carts are what make golf enjoyable. How many of us would actually golf if we couldn't use golf carts?
Yeah, amen to that.
The answer is zero. Amen corner to that.
Yeah, I mean, that's, so we need carts, we need mulligans, we need an amateur group that just started playing out there, we need a jam box with music going. Like, you're telling me this wouldn't increase golf's intrigue and popularity? I think you're crazy, Doug. Right.
Yeah, and you know what else isn't? You know what else isn't legit is all these tee times are exact.
Yeah,
give me a break. I get up there for a 10:37. I'm not teeing off till 10:52. Give me a break.
Yeah, right. It's ish. Everything is 10:37 ish. You know.
Yeah, it's 10:37. You show up. It's like, oh, I'm sorry. Tony Finau group in front of you, they got here a few minutes earlier. They've already teed off.
They went off. So you just hang tight for a little bit here. Just sit tight. That's what you're gonna do. Right? Okay. So we're anchoring SportsCenter tomorrow. Is that what's happening?
Yeah, just showing up, actually. Not SportsCenter at all, but yeah.
You need to just do pull a Costanza and just show up. Just literally show up on the set at SportsCenter, and I think people will be like, yeah, he should, yeah, okay, right. Just go up there, sit down, we'll bike you up, and we're going to go. Like, just do that. Just show up.
Show up in a suit, and we'll tie up Matt Berry in another room. And yep. Say, sorry, I guess he's sick. Yeah, my brother got tickets for kind of a birthday gift or something through his father-in-law who knows somebody. And
wow.
So he's like, well, you want to go? And I said, well, and I'm never the kind of guy that's like, yeah, I want to, you know, I need to go to this sporting event. Like,
me too.
I would much rather stay home.
Amen corner to that.
I would much rather stay home for every sporting event. But this is one of those once in a lifetime deals. My father's flying in.
This is great.
So my dad and I will go tomorrow, and then he'll fly back. My brother will go the other 3 days with his buddy. And
oh god, that's great.
So yeah, looking forward to it. But here's the big obstacle though. Like, we only do things in life to show people and prove to people that we've done them, right? Like,
yep.
There are things you would do. Like, how many people would run a marathon if they couldn't tell anyone that they did it, right? Yeah. The answer is zero. No one would do it.
You'd sign a non-disclosure. You can't. You cannot tell anyone about it. The participations in marathons would dwindle.
Yeah. You want to know how many people would climb Mount Everest if they couldn't tell anybody? The answer is zero. So, so with the Masters, you can't have a phone. And so...
Yeah,
like, I'm not being taken any pictures. I mean, what am I going to do? Check in on Facebook right before I get out of the car?
No one's going to believe you. No one's going to. You're going to be like, you didn't go to the Masters, you liar.
Yeah,
that's what it's going to be.
Well, here's my badge. Yeah, okay.
I got that at a.
Yeah, no, without a phone for like 12 hours.
Well,
what we're going to do. It's going to be weird.
Might as well be the Oregon Trail. You know, it's pretty much what it feels like without a phone now. You're just like, this is. Just
I know. I'll probably catch dysentery and call it a day.
You still got, we'll let you go on this one. You still rocking a Dr. Slice off the tee box because you get your slice game going.
Well, I used to, and, you know, it only took me about 20 years to figure out I was holding the club wrong.
Uh-oh. So you're getting your hooker game going now?
Well, no, I'm getting, well, I don't, as a father of four, I hope I never get my hooker game going.
You're looking, you're getting your Rufio game right?
Looky, I got it.
Would you say you're more Rufio off the tee?
Yeah, I'm definitely more Rufio. You know, I've probably golfed, I think, once in the last 12 months. So
yeah, me too.
As far as I know, I'm long and straight.
There you go. Just tell people that. Hey, man, what's your game like? Long and straight. No, tell us. See if the Rufio joke lands to anybody at Augusta. Okay.
I think that's on the list of banned phrases.
Yeah, dilly-dilly, Rufio. You're like, dang it. Like, yep. Good joke.
Right. Sorry, can't do it.
Yep,
looky-looky.
Yep. All right. All right, Matt. Well, we're 2 minutes over from what you allotted us. I apologize that my producer can't read, and I hear a child screaming for you. So you go take care of that child and enjoy the Masters, all right?
Yep, he's screaming at me.
Okay,
all right.
There you go.
We'll see,
right.
Buddy.
See ya.
Right.
There's Matt Schick. So it is ESPN... posted their FBI win totals. The FBI projected win totals for college football next year. And Nebraska is projected at 5.5 wins. And it is so interesting to contrast that and the reaction to it when you compare it to last year's reaction. Do you remember last year? It was the same projection last year, if I'm not mistaken. Last season, Nebraska was projected to win 5.5 games. And it was met with anger. People found it laughable. People were upset last year. 5.5, what? This year, at least today, it's like, yeah, whatever. I think it's a perfect storm of hitting rock bottom last year with getting Frost back and that bringing about the correct amount of patience needed from the fans that is leading to people not burning the FBI to the ground today on social media? Because even though people are all fired up for Scott Frost, his arrival hasn't necessarily brought out a rash of unrealistic expectations. Have you guys noticed that? Like, I'm yet to talk to anyone that's like, I think Nebraska can go 11-1 next year. I think Nebraska can go, 10 wins at least. Nebraska will win the West. I don't think I've talked to anyone that says that. People were saying that in year one of Riley. So even though people are all fired up for Frost, people haven't lost their minds. Now, I mean, is it possible Nebraska wins 8, 9, 10 games? Sure, it's possible. I mean, how many people thought Purdue would do what they did last year? How many people thought Michigan in year one under Harbaugh would do what they did? Hell, even go back, I understand Urban Meyer is Urban Meyer, but how many people after Luke Fickell and what that Ohio State team, how many people thought Urban Meyer would come in first year Ohio State undefeated? Not very many people thought that. So it's possible, but it's also possible and plausible that Nebraska goes 6-6 or 5-7. When you realistically look at this thing, changing schemes, both sides of the ball, regardless of who you start, you're going to have a young, inexperienced quarterback under center, and you also have a really, really tough schedule. It's possible. And it's, I don't want to say that winning games doesn't matter next year. It does. Like, I'd be really disappointed if, you know, Nebraska won like what, 3 or 4 games, or you want to see more progress than that. But in the midst of this rebuild and flipping the culture, it feels like people are more into that than winning 9 games or something like that in year one. At least that's my read. And I think the reaction to the FPI projected win total for Nebraska kind of at 5.5 kind of reflects that. People are like, yeah, okay. There's not a bunch of anger. There's not a bunch of rage. There's not a bunch of venom. There isn't a bunch of negative emotion with that. And when you compare that to last year, oh, man, last year was like the world, like 5.5. What? Now, I get some of that's a product of Nebraska was coming off a season where they won 9 games, and you're going a year 3 of a new coach. I'm understand that, but still. I just think your reaction today is kind of like, eh. I've told you that when I look at things and take it all, I see 6-6, maybe 7-5. Like, I think Nebraska probably beats Akron, Troy, Colorado, Illinois, Purdue, Minnesota, Northwestern, in that, like, probably the swing games on the season to me are like Northwestern, Colorado, Purdue, and Michigan State. How Nebraska does in those 4 games are the difference between Nebraska winning 4, 5, or 6 or winning like 6, 7, 8. So I think right now, I mean, games at Michigan, at Ohio State, at Wisconsin, hell, even at Iowa, probably going to be tough to win. So, you know, to me, I see 6 or 7 wins. I think that's reasonable to look at when you take into consideration you could have a true freshman, you could have a redshirt freshman, you could have you're going to have some youth and inexperience littered across the board. You're going to be flipping schemes. You're going to be playing a really tough schedule. So I see 6 or 7 wins, but I certainly think a projection of 5.5 is totally plausible. Totally plausible. Because I could certainly look at things and go, tell you what, If things don't break right and you don't get, you know, one of the quarterbacks doesn't step up, like, 5 wins isn't out of the question. Not out of the question. John emails in and with 5.5 win projection last year. He said, people were upset with Nebraska's win projection last year because they refused to believe what their eyes told them. After seeing what they saw last year, they are very excited about the upcoming season, but the expectations are tempered. The hiring of Scott Frost has also helped temper emotions. Fans feel like he is one of them. I agree. In general, it's been amazing. You would think that with Frost around here, that like the emotions and the like it'd be like crazy and this, like it's not, it's like the conversations have been pretty reasonable. The talking points have felt pretty reasonable. Even for someone like me to come on the air and be like, yeah, I can see Nebraska going 6-6. I'm not getting any emails of being like, oh, God, bah, hate, ridiculous, idiot. I'm not getting any of that. So I was like, yeah, you know, possible. Got a lot of work to do. Trust Scott. I think there's also a trust level there, too. You know what I mean? Like, it's easier to maybe take some lumps when you trust and truly believe that it's coming. You know what I mean? Like, it's easier to endure some anger and frustration and negative. Like, it's easier to endure all that when you truthfully believe that in the future, great times are coming. And maybe that's a part of it, too. Maybe a lot of the anger and venom and negativity in last year's projection was rooted in, oh my God, if it's not coming this year, that like it's rooted in a subconscious never really believed in Riley. But, you know, today, 5.5 wins projection, there you go. By the way, they have Nebraska at 5.5 wins, and they would be fifth in the Big Ten West. Because, obviously, Wisconsin's projected at 9.6 wins, so they would win that division. Iowa is projected at 8.2 wins, which seems high to me. I don't know what you think, Corey. That seems a little high. Does that seem high? I haven't looked at their schedule.
A lot of that could be based on schedule.
Sure. But
they got a pretty decent schedule.
Northwestern is at 6.3 wins. And then Minnesota's at 5.7 wins. So Nebraska's at 5.5, Minnesota's at 5.7, then Purdue's at 5.4. So how about that? Between Nebraska, Purdue, and Minnesota, it's like 1.5.7, 1.5.5, 1.5.4.
What was Wisconsin at again?
9.6.
9.6. Ooh.
9.6. On the East, if you're interested, Ohio State is picked to win the East at 10.3 projected wins, followed by Penn State at 9.7, then this is, wow. Third is Michigan State at 9.5. Then Michigan at 8.6. Then you got Maryland at 4.7, Indiana at 4.5, and Rutgers at 4.3. So there you go. That's the FPI, the latest with that. By the way, so Tiger obviously hit it in the water on 12, but did go up and down and made a pretty good it looked like maybe a 10-12 footer to save bogey. That's a big putt. It's a big putt. So maybe sometimes making a big putt, even if it's to save bogey, can kind of get you rolling. Maybe that'll kind of get him rolling.
Thank you for listening to today's Best of Game Time podcast. Hear Nick's entire past show on 1620thezone.com's Game Time podcast page and live 11 a.m. to 2 p.m. weekdays on 1620 The Zone, the 1620 The Zone app, and 1620thezone.com.